future, please email makingcontact@kpfk.org. That's makingcontact@kpfk.org.
Hi, this is Shepard Ferry, and you're listening to People Powered Radio on KPFK 90.7 FM, Los Angeles. I'm about
to have a nervous breakdown. Those key things are put right now for us as boosting unionization, tripling union density is a key part of that, pushing back against mass deportation, showing the negative economic impacts of mass deportation, showing the strategy from the Trump administration.
Good memories are forever, said the dog on the tombstone. If you're living underneath the bridge, man, all roads lead to home. I got a hidden flask, I'm paid in cash, got a cross above my bed. You know, I hitchhiked from Chicago, and a man walked up and said, this is a union town, all down.
Good morning, and welcome to another Working Week. This is KPFK's Working Voices. I'm your host, Joe Ayala, president of NABIT CWA Local 53.
And I'm your co-host, Marissa Remsky of CWA Local 9003.
And in today's show, we bring you part two of our executive producer, Dan McCrory's interview with Heidi Schurls of the Economic Policy Institute. Steve Zeltzer brings us a taste of last week's National Day of Action back at the BlackRock Investments Building in San Francisco. And our associate producer, Hal Lohr, has the latest Working Voices update. All this and more coming up. This is Working Voices.
First up this morning, Steve Zeltzer takes us to last week's National Day of Action rally that he hosted in San Francisco at BlackRock Investments to hear opposition voices to that company's contracts and the USA's programs of ICE for roundups, for profit prisons, and massive spying on immigrants and all workers in the United States and around the world.
Question evidence to the contrary. Ridicule all the people in the know. Look away, because it's all too big and scary. And denial is the easy way to go. Put your faith in our aging institutions, even though they're not up to a changing tide. Carry on while the world around you's burning. No one can be allowed to dent your pride.
I want to welcome you all here today. My name is Steve Zeltzer, and I'm with the United Front Committee for Labor Party. Also, I'm a member of the News Guild. And we're here today in front of BlackRock, investment company in San Francisco. The reason we're having it at BlackRock is that, in fact, BlackRock, the capitalists, the billionaires who run BlackRock are profiting from the incarceration. They're profiting from Geocorp. They're profiting from Palantir and the others who are making money off of the attack on immigrants and the movement towards a fascist state. The U.S. government now is controlled by these techno-fascists who are attacking all our democratic rights, and this they're profiting from it. These capitalists and billionaires have taken over direct control of the state. And we believe that these concentration camps, deportation centers, which are being established around the country, are in preparation not just for immigrants, but for workers, trade unionists, and militants in this country. So it's not just about immigrants and attacking immigrants. It's about setting up a fascist state to attack the working class. And the role of the Democratic Party in this is very clear. The Democrats just voted to continue funding for the U.S. government, to continue the support for the military in Iran and the militarization of the United States military around the world. Well, one of the things that happens when capitalism goes into crisis is you have blaming immigrants, blaming migrants. Let's be clear, the rise of fascism internationally is a direct result of imperialist war. the fascists blame them for the economic crisis. So there's a worldwide campaign against immigration, against migrants. And we believe that we have to have a united front of working class people, of the trade unions against these attacks. Where are the unions? That's what we're asking today. So we have to really organize for the labor movement, the unions, to mobilize against the attack on migrants and immigrants and these concentration camps. They're an attack not just on the immigrants and migrants, but they're attack on the entire working class. At the same time, they're attacking the migrants and immigrants in this country. They're trying to resegregate and attack Black representation. This government is, and the Republicans are redistricting with the support of the Supreme Court to eliminate Black representation. They're getting rid of the Civil Rights Act, and they want to resegregate the South and the United States. This is a issue not only for the Black working class, it's the issue for the entire working class. And we believe that there needs to be national action, national day of action against the attack on the rights of Blacks and against the resegregation and attack on Black representation. Historically, when capitalists go into crisis, this is what you have, inter-imperialist rivalry, which is what's happening internationally, nationalism, which they're trying to whip up, and attacks on the unions. But the fact of the matter is, this attack on the working class has to be mobilized against. One of the things that we believe is that the threat of a dictatorship of martial law is imminent. Trump and the people who are in the Congress, Johnson and Vance, are the people who actually supported the insurrection and coup. Let's be clear. The people that support the insurrection and coup are in charge of the government. If Johnson refuses to open up the Congress after the elections, there will be no transfer of power, and the Republicans will still have control. But they are not going to allow a transfer of power. That's what they're saying. They want to continue the attack on the working class, and they want to prevent even bourgeois democracy. So we have to be clear that this period that we're in is a very dangerous period for the working class, and it's when the working class needs to organize politically and with militant struggles and militant actions. The other thing is, last thing I want to say before our first speaker, is that the silence of the trade union bureaucracy in this country is very dangerous. When 700,000 workers had their contracts canceled by Trump, AFSCME and others, largest attack on public workers in the United States, complete silence by the unions. Not one rally, not one national action. Here you have the unions being directly attacked by the Trump fascist government, and none of the unions, including the public workers unions, called for a national day of action. Why it is because they're afraid of fighting the government. They're afraid of fighting the Democrats. They're afraid of mobilizing the working class. That's exactly what's required if we're going to defend the working class. And today at this rally, you have all these police here. They're apparently, Mayor Lurie and the Democrats who run San Francisco have no problem of extending the budget, increasing the budget of the police department by millions and millions of dollars while they're cutting social services, while they're cutting clinics, healthcare clinics in San Francisco. So the Democratic Party, which runs San Francisco, which runs California, is allowing the attack on immigrants. In fact, at the airport, SFO, the San Francisco police were actually helping ICE in their arrest of people. We can't rely on the Democrats. We can't rely on the politicians. And the union bureaucracy has refused to speak out and organize and call any kind of mass action. For our first speaker is Kathy Ikeami.
So I'm Kathy Ikeami. I'm speaking for the Spartacist League. Trump's anti-immigrant blitz has swept across the U.S. from Minneapolis to L.A., Chicago, and elsewhere. The current push to round up and deport immigrants is a product of the social decay of U.S. imperialism. Trump is tearing up what's left of the old liberal order because it no longer serves the ruling class in maintaining its grip on the globe. Trump's anti-immigrant campaign is about forcing the entire working class into submission. The struggle to defend immigrants must be on a firm and consistent working class basis, and to fight for that same strategy within the labor movement. Tens of thousands of furious protesters braved sub-zero temperatures in Minnesota last January, but this was not a general strike. The unionist leaders talked tough about shutting Minneapolis down, but there were no union contingents, no call out to the ranks collectively. Without waging labor's powerful strike weapon, immigrants and workers will pay for it with their very lives. The only way to win workers to defend immigrants is by showing them that it is vital to their interest, to defending themselves. Trump's anti-immigrant campaign is about forcing the entire working class into submission. No reliance on the Democrats, the other party of U.S. imperialism. Now, I want to talk briefly about Prairie Land. I was in Texas in June for the sentencing hearings where eight of the defendants were convicted on bogus terrorism charges. They were slapped with 30 to 100 years in prison for their demonstration at the ICE facility on July 4th, 2025. They have been in prison since then in terrible conditions, frequently strip searched. They're treated like dogs, and they're now locked up. The witch hunt against these activists is the front line of Trump's campaign to outlaw anyone who opposes government policy. Terrorism accusations are the same lies used against pro-Palestinian activists and anti-ICE protesters. We call to free the Prairie Land defendants, drop the charges against the Minneapolis 15 and all anti-ICE and pro-Palestinian activists. It will be a crime if disgust with Donald Trump's rampages around the world is once again channeled into labor support for the Democrats. Genuine international labor solidarity can only be built on the basis of irreconcilable opposition to U.S. imperialism and all its parties and agencies. Thank you.
One of the things that we are united here in this National Day of Action is that we need the action of the working class. We need a general strike against these attacks. The working class has the power to stop it. Appeals to the politicians to stop it is not going to happen. Protests are ignored by this fascist government. Protests will not stop fascism. Protests will not stop the detention centers and the ICE Gestapo agents. Only direct militant working class action can stop that. So our next speaker is Norma from the Freedom Socialist Party.
Thank you, everyone, for being here. My name is Norma Gallegos. I'm a daughter of Mexican immigrants. I'm with the Freedom Socialist Party and also Radical Women. Thank you to the organizers of this day of action. We need to continue defending and being in solidarity with immigrants, refugees, detainees, and activists. They are workers and have the right to be here. We need to keep calling out the repression, capitalist exploitation, and murder of innocent lives for profit. And it is only by us, by being out here and being vocal, that I believe workers and the community can stop the brutal injustices against our relatives. The bosses and government aren't the ones who create the wealth in this country, but they scapegoat and attack those who do. Working people, immigrants, and the most marginalized who endure the worst treatment imaginable. I want to point out the plight of women, queer people, and children in the detention centers. Right now, these taxpayer-built detention centers, trans folk are being severely mistreated. They're held for longer periods of time, have a high rate of sexual assaults, have unsafe housing conditions, and are being denied medical care, including mental health, HIV, and hormone therapy. This is a reflection of how brazenly everyone in there is being stripped of their rights, dignity, and livelihoods. As for women, earlier this year, the Department of Homeland Security reported 363 pregnant, postpartum, and nursing immigrants had been deported, and there were 16 detainees who had miscarriages. Women are also being sexually assaulted, with many of the cases not being reported nor investigated by the feds or even local authorities. Children are being taken unaccompanied, abused, traumatized, and deported. We must continue to build on these brave strikes, protests, and marches against these horrifying violations of human rights. We demand the immediate release of the elderly, sick, and the most vulnerable detainees, legal review of their cases, and an end to pressuring captives to self-deport. We must build a united front to fuse together detainee organizers, community groups, the left, and the power of the labor unions. Like, why not slow down work production to stop ICE abductions and end the policy of deportations by having a general strike? Together, there's no limit to the world we want to fight for and make better. We must also demand to open the borders and demand unconditional amnesty for all. Ningún humano es ilegal. No human is illegal. Abolish ICE and stop the deportations. Thank you.
Divert when people ask hard questions. Hide agendas with convoluted spin. Make a joke of your shady indiscretions. For distraction is a proven way to win. Shout down all reasonable objections. Let your conscience and integrity defer. Carry on while the world around you's burning, and pretend we can go on just as we were.
You're listening to Working Voices on KPFK 90.7 FM, Los Angeles.
We're here in front of BlackRock, which is the largest, one of the largest capitalist investment companies in the world. And one of the major parts of their investment is in AI and Palantir and General Dynamics. This company and the billionaires who own this company, control it, are actually profiting from this imperialist war. They're profiting from the attack on immigrants. This company, BlackRock, is profiting off of the incarceration and the torture in these detention camps. These people are criminals, the people who run this company. They're criminals, and they're destroying people in this country and around the world. They're profiting from it. And that is exactly what capitalism does. They use the control of capital to exploit and to destroy labor conditions, and to create slave labor. That is exactly what this company, BlackRock, is doing. General Dynamics also has gotten contracts for the care, quote unquote, care of children in the detention centers. Imagine that. They're profiting by incarcerating children and then supposedly taking care of them. This is a rotten, corrupt system, reactionary system, and capitalism is at the core of this. This is why the movement for migrants, the movement for workers, the movement for war is a movement against capitalism. And one of the things we have to build is a workers' party against the Democrats and Republicans. The Democrats and Republicans are both equally responsible for these war crimes. The Democrats have supported the security state, have supported the incarceration of immigrants. And Clinton and others have supported laws taking away democratic rights. So this attack on the working class is not an issue just of Trump and the fascist government. It's an issue of the capitalist system and both capitalist parties. And one of the attacks that's going on now with Trump's budget is the attack on home care workers. It's an attack on the people of California. And the Democrats are instituting cuts in Medicaid. The Democrats, Newsom, and the legislature are saying they don't have money. I mean, imagine that. In California, saying you don't have money for poor people, for home care workers, when there are more billionaires in California than almost any place in the world, and they don't have money. That's because the Democrats are supporting these billionaires. That's why they don't want to go after the billionaires. They don't want to go after BlackRock. They want to have a transit tax in the Bay Area to make working people pay for transit instead of these big companies. The Democrats have blood on their hands. The Democrats are carrying out austerity and attacks on the working class. So our next speaker is a home care worker. He's a member of SEIU 2015, and he was at a rally yesterday at the headquarters of SEIU 2015, which has 400,000 members demanding that they support, imagine, a billionaire's tax. They're taking a neutral position on even supporting a billionaire's tax. This is the SEIU, which has over 750,000 members in California. Welcome, Bradley.
It's outrageous, the situation that we're finding ourselves in. BlackRock and the pirate inequity, private equity vultures that are destroying wealth in this country. Home care and health care and nursing homes and our food assistance, SNAP, are all facing a cliff in January when the effects of Trump's HR1 of last July 4th hits, and there's no answer that is coming from either of the oligarch parties, either the Democrats or the Republicans. We have to take things into our own hands, and one wing, one union of SEIU standing up for its members and the source of finance for county hospitals, for rural hospitals, for San Francisco General Hospital. We're going to be facing department cuts and the emergency room going crazy. I'm a member of SEIU 2015, the home care union for 3/5 of the counties in California. And our union is neutral on the SEIU UHW sponsored Prop 40, 1.5 million Californians signed petitions demanding that the billionaires pay their fair share, that they begin to approach what working people pay every day. We pay our almost 9% on sales tax, and these people are going to spend $100 million in lies over the summer and into November 3rd to defeat Prop 40. And they have placed on the ballot two phony initiatives that nullify Prop 40 if it actually wins. And right now, of the Democratic electorate in California that intends to vote in November 3rd, a poll has shown 57% support Prop 40. So what's going on? We have Newsom and a wing of the Democratic Party siding with their oligarch sponsors and opposing Prop 40. We have to support that proposition. We have to defeat Prop 41 and 42, which are fake initiatives put forward by the billionaires to nullify 40 if they 41 and 42 get more votes. So support healthcare workers, home care workers, nursing home workers, and food assistance workers. And tell your friends, rally for Prop 40. We need to have public funding of services supported by the people that are stealing the money that is made, that are skimming off. Now, BlackRock is one of these private equity people. The next crisis we're going to be facing is the insurance collapse, because they have gone after the insurance industry and sucked it dry. And the states will have to pay off the collapse of insurance. I thought it was going to be crypto crash was coming next, but it's going to be the insurance crash that firms like BlackRock that have vulturized capitalism to the point where they don't produce anything. They only suck out of capitalism wealth. And Trump and his wing of the capitalists have made this the United States of the oligarchy. They are welcoming foreign oligarchs, world oligarchy. They want to compete and they want to have the favorable, but they're dealing with the criminality around the world. And we just saw industrial associations denouncing the attack on immigrants because it's disrupting their economy. The most exploited workers are being denied to these corporations. So we have to utilize the divisions among these criminals that are sucking us dry and turning over it to the global oligarchs under the control of this one wing. So we need to support Prop 40. We need to begin to work in our unions to demand a general strike if Trump sends troops or ICE into the poll. If there's a movement for that, we've got to block him and let him know he cannot disrupt the Democratic election. That has to be high on our list of things to do. And we are working to build a coalition in SEIU, California, that will be calling for that and supporting Prop 40, even though our leaders are neutral on taxing the people that have the money that we have made in this society. Thank you so much.
One of the issues is this imperialist wars in the United States did not start recently. They've been going on since when the United States at war with Spain took over Cuba, took over the Philippines, and took over Puerto Rico. And the fight in Puerto Rico is important for us because, in fact, the ICE raids are taking place in Puerto Rico against Dominicans. And they're militarizing Puerto Rico, much like they're militarizing Okinawa for war with China. So we have to connect these struggles internationally. So that's what we're talking about, a united front. We have to build a united front movement in this country. That means organizations have to work together around class issues. It's important we break down the sectarianism. There should be thousands of people marching today against the attack on immigrants, against ICE and these detention centers. We have to break down the sectarianism. We have to have united fronts. I want to thank you all for coming today. We are going to continue this united front around fighting ICE, fighting the concentration camps, and mobilizing in the labor movement, the working class, for a general strike. So thank you. Solidarity. Stop the raids. Free the people. Shut the detention centers. General strike now. Thank you, brothers and sisters.
Your faith in our aging institutions, even though they're not up to a changing tide. Carry on while the world around you's burning. No one can be allowed to dent your pride.
That was Steve Zeltzer from his Labor Video YouTube channel. For more videos and insights from Steve Zeltzer, you can go to his Labor Video YouTube channel, or now you can find him at the Production of Labor Video Project on the web at labormedia.net.
Hi, this is Lila Downs. You're listening to KPFK 90.7 FM Los Angeles, 98.7 FM Santa Barbara, globally on kpfk.org.
Si porque te quiero, quieres llorona que yo.
In the next half of the hour this morning, our Working Voices executive producer, Dan McCrory, brings us the second half of his interview with Heidi Shierholz, president of the Economic Policy Institute, a nonprofit, nonpartisan think tank that serves working people and a leading voice for a worker-centered policy agenda, who formerly served the Obama administration as chief economist at the Department of Labor.
Are you familiar with the Powell memo?
Yes. Wait, fill me in. That was the
1971.
70s. Yes.
Lewis Powell, who had yes. been famous for telling SCOTUS that tobacco was not addicting.
Yes.
And he was approached by the U.S. Chamber of Commerce about putting together a paper to shut up all the people coming back from Vietnam and the hippies from saying that we were only still there because there was money to be made. And so they took over the conversation, and they've been very successful with that since. Nixon was so impressed, he appointed him to the Supreme Court. And I was wondering if we have any model that's been developed to sort of thwart the aims of the Powell manifesto?
It's a good question. I do think EPI was part of the reason to form EPI in the beginning was as a counterbalance to what came out of that Powell memo on the right, like this real pushing for, academic sounding kind of work that would be real, sort of weaponizing the tools of economics to try to pass economic policy that would really funnel the gains of productivity growth to the top, right? Like that was the ultimate goal. And we saw that happening like crazy, like in the wake of the Powell memo, like institutions being stood up that really did that really, really successfully. And so I don't know, I can't name a thing that is exactly like that on the progressive side, but it definitely was one of the sort of antecedents, right? Not in the way that EPI is a result of an error of the Powell memo, but because of the things it started, created the situation where EPI was really, really, really needed.
Yeah, and I actually studied the whole issue of the Powell memo. And I said, what we need to do is steal the whole damn thing and just replace certain words. And it works fine because it's been proven that it works to keep certain people in power and other people.
Mm-hmm.
So mm-hmm. If we just replace those words, it would work for us.
You should be the one to write that thing. That can be your next book.
Actually, I'm working on that. My next book takes countries like Canada, France, Morocco, and Thailand, and says, does the way you treat your working class get reflected in the global economy?
Oh, fascinating. Yes. I've been evoking Canada recently in a lot of conversations because EPI just put out a paper envisioning a world where we have 30% union density. So right now the union density in the US is about 10%. And so it's like, what will be the impact on wages and benefits? And we even go into like community measures and democracy measures. And it's just let's think big here. Like what would this look like? What could this get us? But in conversations around it, I always feel like I need to remind people, look, this isn't pie in the sky. So first of all, we were higher than that 50 years ago before the real impact of the massive attacks on unions and collective bargaining really had an impact. Mm-hmm. So we've been there before. And it's not just a historical thing because our neighbors to the north, Canada, currently have a union density rate of over 30%. So they have an industrial relations system that is very similar to ours. They just did not let their workers' rights to unions and collective bargaining sort of wither on the vine as happened in the US. So so those kinds of international comparisons are just incredibly useful in at least this case for imagining what could be possible here.
Yeah, actually, I was studying France and saw that the government is very involved in negotiations for wages, hours, and working conditions. They're right there at the table. And I took heart from that maybe something like that could eventually happen here.
Yeah, that's interesting. And when you think of like Biden being the first president to go on a picket line, first sitting president to join a picket line, which he did. And those, like, we are in a different moment. I mean, obviously we're in a different moment now with the current president, but I mean, one thing that's as far as the public's interest in unions, like popularity of unions is like near record highs. When people are asked, who do they trust? Like they don't trust any institutions, but they trust unions. Like it is just that there is, people are surveyed, they're like, we want unions to be stronger. One thing that I cite a lot is when people are surveyed about would you join a union at your workplace if you could, and over 40% of non-union workers say, yep, I would vote for a union tomorrow in my workplace if I could. Like, they're just really popular right now, which does make it seem like there's something of an opening.
How do you guys go about deciding what you're going to look into, and where do you garner most of that information?
Yeah, it's we have strategic conversations about what we can plan for, what's moving, and then there's the, especially like in this environment when there's just stuff coming all the time that you can't plan for, and you just have to be agile and be able to move quickly. But like, we usually have a few sort of broad areas that we're particularly focusing on, while knowing we also need to be agile and respond to the things that come over the transom on a daily basis. But those key things are put right now for us is boosting unionization, and that work around tripling union density is a key part of that. Pushing back against mass deportation, showing the negative economic impacts of mass deportation, showing the strategy from the Trump administration to deport lots of immigrants and then bring people back on temporary guest worker visas, which are very exploitative, or maybe not the same people, but bring in other immigrants on temporary guest worker visas, like just how bad that is. That trade-off is not just for immigrant workers, but for U.S.-born workers who work alongside these folks. So immigration, unionization, given the relentless attacks on the public sector, we also have this particular emphasis right now on just how unbelievably important the public sector is to the kind of economy that we want, and how, like, far from slashing the public sector, we need to be building it up. And then another thing we're really focused on right now is the conversation around affordability. Like, there is this big, you know, it feels like that's the new buzzword, right? Like, everyone's talking about affordability. I do hate in general how these sort of buzzwords come and go in the public conversations. But as far as buzzwords go, I don't hate affordability, because it gets at something real about what the economy is delivering for working people. But one of the issues with affordability is that people talk about it almost entirely in terms of prices. Like, the only way apparently you can make life more affordable is to make things cheaper. That's not true. We know that affordability is about both prices and wages. And we have a big, like, we need to remind people how to talk about affordability, and it's in terms of whether you earn enough to cover the cost of living with dignity. And those, you just have to bring in both sides of the equation. And honestly, for policymakers, there are a lot more levers that policymakers can pull on wages than they can pull on prices. Like, prices, there's not a whole lot of control. I mean, this administration is clearly doing things that are spiking prices, namely broad chaotic tariffs. Tariffs can be an incredibly important, useful tool when used strategically. That is not what this administration is doing. So their tariffs, really, you're just getting the bad, not the good. So price increases, and also obviously the war in Iran. So this administration is doing things to spike prices. But in general, it's actually really quite hard for administrations to bring prices down. But there is a lot that they can do to raise wages. And so that's the, we're just trying to make sure that that conversation is not just one-sided.
Just a couple more questions. How much do you have the ear of labor leaders?
So Liz Schuler, the president of the AFL-CIO, is the chair of EPI's board. And we have a whole lot of labor leaders on our board. So it is, I would say, we are still labor think tank, right? Like, it is still, it is I mean, now a much larger share of our funding comes from foundations, like just the foundations that you hear about in the news. But we still work very closely with our union partners.
Yeah, I wouldn't want you to feel like you're out there in the wilderness by yourselves.
Right.
So how can we support the organization?
Well, you can always support the organization by literally by going to the donate button. If you go to epi.org, there is a donate button. We would love to have any financial support. There is also just reading our stuff, talking about it, recirculating it on social media, just like getting the word out. Like, what we want is for people to have a framework, a way of thinking about the economy that really centers not just the already affluent, right? That also really centers low and middle income people. And so that is a way to support EPI also. Just read the stuff and really use it at the Thanksgiving table and all the other places where you're talking to people about how the economy works and what policymakers need to do to make change.
You're listening to Working Voices on KPFK 90.7 FM Los Angeles.
As you know, I would love to do a series of interviews about some of the things that you guys are covering. And I was wondering if you could give me sort of a sneak preview of what we'll be talking about.
Oh, so I think the things that you will be talking about might reflect the things that I just brought up, like our work on unionization, our work on immigration, our work on the public sector, our work around affordability. One thing that we're doing work on now, which is not in that list, but could be, is on the impact of technology on the labor market. Right. Like, honestly, and now that's coming up a lot with AI, right? But I mean, we've seen these waves of technology over and over and over again. Honestly, EPI, one of the reasons EPI was founded, I didn't emphasize this before, but it had to do with the fact that these sort of neoliberal economists who would be like, you know, these things, these foundational institutions actually hurt rather than help, which is not true. One of the other things that they would say is that inequality is the result of it's just the natural outcome of a modern economy. Like, these giant wages for the top, it's like suppressed wages for working people. It's just, you know, that's just how it is in a modern economy, which is absolutely not true. There were there were really specific crushing of labor standards and their enforcement, crushing of unions, trade agreements that pitted our workers with much lower wage workers around the world, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. It was not natural. It was all policy choice after policy choice after policy choice that funneled money to the top. Sorry, that's a long way to say that technology in the beginning was used as part of that conversation to say, oh, this rising inequality is happening because of technology, and there is nothing we can or probably even would want to do, right? And that's just not what was really happening. And we're seeing that popping up again today and helping people see that history and what are constructive ways to really talk about the impact of the new round of technology that we're seeing now, AI, that is taking up a lot of our time also at this point.
Yeah, and it's been addressed by the AFL-CIO and other unions who see a massive job loss on the horizon.
Yeah, we're certainly not seeing that yet, right? Like it is, like we're well into the AI revolution and you cannot really see the impact of AI on the U.S. labor market at this point. Like if you look at, you know, there's all these measures of what occupations are exposed to AI or not exposed to AI. And you can look at those, the shares of people who work in these different groups, like high exposure occupations, low exposure occupations. And what you see is like, those shares haven't changed. Like you're not, if AI were massively impacting the labor market, you would see a big decline in the share of workers who are in like high exposed occupations. You would see a big surge in productivity growth. That you would see because if AI is all of a sudden making it so like companies can produce a ton more with a lot fewer workers, because they're having AI do a bunch of stuff, then you would see a surge in productivity, the amount that is generated per hour worked. And we're not seeing that at all. So it does not, we're not yet really seeing a footprint of big displacement from AI. And I will say that I do worry about the conversation about massive displacement from AI has a potential negative side to it, right? Like, because there is nothing that creates a more docile workforce than believing that your job is on like the knife edge of being destroyed. Like, that is not a situation where workers speak up for their rights. And so I do think that there is, let's just say that companies have a real incentive to scare workers about the implications of AI. We're not seeing it yet. I'm not saying it won't affect some jobs. It absolutely will, but nobody has a crystal ball. But my guess is the impact of AI is going to be kind of like the impact of the internet, right? Like it affected some jobs. It changed the way we do work for sure. It absolutely changed the way we do work, but it was much more modest than the way many people are talking about AI today. And I think in fact, it's the kind of the, that lessons there should be the way that we're talking about the AI today.
Well, I hope you're right.
I hope I'm right too. Yeah.
My biggest fear is that you're wrong. Because, for instance, the new movie Odyssey, I don't know if you've seen it.
I haven't seen it yet. I've got to get to it.
I think that was a deliberate, demonstration by management that they said, see, you can't make a movie like this with AI because there's all this massive groups of people in the film that are fighting the ocean and all sorts of each other. And I think they made a real case for not AI.
Yeah, because they made that without any CGI either, right? Is that right?
There might be some in there. Not a lot.
I don't know what I might have that wrong. Yeah. I'm looking forward to seeing it, but I have not yet.
Thank you, Heidi. I appreciate you taking the time to talk to
us. Thank you
listeners.
So much. Yeah. And, it was lovely to talk with you.
Thank you.
That was Working Voices executive producer Dan McCrory in part two of his interview with Heidi Shierholz of the Economic Policy Institute. And for more information about the Economic Policy Institute, you can find them at epi.org. That's epi.org.
Never get paid what our labor is worth. That's why we often in a daze on the way to our work. And when we get there, we can't wait to be out. So let me tell you what it's about.
Hi, this is Halle Berry, and you're listening to KPFK 90.7 FM.
And finally, from the KPFK News Desk, Associate Producer Hal Lohr brings us this morning's Working Voices update.
The representative from California has the floor.
Thank you, Marissa. Let's talk tech jobs as San Jose tech company Cisco plans to cut 471 workers in three Bay Area offices, according to layoff notices filed to a state agency. The tech company, which provides networking services along with other services including video conferencing, cybersecurity, and other services, told employees in May that it was going to cut fewer than 4,000 jobs or less than 5% of its workforce. The notices, processed by the California Employment Development Department this week, provide more details about what jobs Cisco will cut in California. The artificial intelligence boom has fueled more investment in data centers, commercial real estate, and other areas, but advancements in AI tools have also been reshaping jobs, especially in Silicon Valley, the epicenter of the AI tech industry. Cisco's layoffs in California impacted workers in its San Jose, Milpitas, and San Francisco offices, and the company cut a variety of roles in software engineering, product management, design, business operations, and other areas. Cisco said it didn't have anything additional to share beyond what it published in May about its restructuring plans, but tech companies have been citing various reasons for layoffs, including prioritizing investment in artificial intelligence, as workers use AI-powered tools to generate code, words, and other content. Some executives have said they simply don't need as many employees. There's also skepticism, though, about how big a role AI is playing at companies with a large amount of workers globally. From January to May, U.S. technology companies announced 123,653 cuts. That's up to 66% from the same period in 2025, according to a June report from the firm Challenger Gray & Christmas. That firm said that AI was the leading reason companies cited for the job cuts, but it still isn't the job apocalypse some predicted. Even as Meta, Snap, Block, Oracle, and Amazon are among tech companies that have announced mass layoffs this year. Cisco markets itself for the AI era and has benefited from the AI boom, reaching a record revenue of $15.8 billion in the third quarter this year alone. And the company's net income grew 35% to $3.4 billion year over year during that quarter. Cisco's chief executive, Chuck Robbins, told employees in May it's cutting costs in certain areas while prioritizing other investments. That includes employee use of AI across the company. As of July 2025, though, Cisco had roughly 86,200 employees, according to its annual report. And in United Auto Workers news, President Sean Fain, who is being investigated by a federal grand jury, has hired two former federal prosecutors who specialize in fraud and bribery cases and work as defense lawyers for a Washington, D.C. firm with a stable of high-profile clients, including trillionaire Elon Musk and former New York City Mayor Eric Adams. The hiring of lawyers Robert Zink and Ben O'Neill of the law firm Quinn, Emanuel, Urquhart, and Sullivan comes amid an investigation focused on allegations Fain pressured another high-ranking union official to secure benefits for his fiancée and her sister, according to the Detroit News. The hirings hint at possible federal crimes being scrutinized in an investigation that increases pressure on the union weeks away from when UAW members will decide whether to elect Fain to a second term as president. The probe also coincides with attempts by the UAW to free itself from a years-long corruption scandal that sent two former UAW presidents, labor leaders, and automotive executives to federal prison. More than a dozen people, including public officials and labor leaders convicted of corruption crimes, have been freed after serving a fraction of their prison sentence in recent years. But the Detroit News reports that no dues money is being used in Fain's defense in connection with the DOJ investigation, at least according to a UAW spokesperson. Zink and O'Neill, on the other hand, work for a firm with a long history with Elon Musk, and in 2023, the firm won a multi-billion dollar securities trial that ended with jurors concluding Musk and Tesla were not liable for misleading investors. Zink is the former head of the fraud section of the U.S. Justice Department's criminal division and acting deputy assistant attorney general who spent more than a decade prosecuting fraud and bribery cases. That included a 2012 conviction of Miami area doctors convicted of participating in a $205 million Medicare fraud scheme, the largest such fraud in U.S. history at the time. O'Neill, meanwhile, focuses on white-collar and corporate investigations. During his career as a federal lawyer, he worked foreign bribery, financial, and healthcare fraud. The hiring signal, a concern for Fain, said Harley Shaken, a labor expert and professor emeritus at the University of California, Berkeley, indicating concerns about where this might go when you hire attorneys at that level. After all, they're very expensive. But it doesn't reflect guilt, they say. That's for a judge or a jury to decide. In bad news for the otherwise incredibly profitable gaming industry, Microsoft announced 4,800 job cuts last week, or about 1.2% of its global workforce, including a large number of workers at its Xbox video game business. The layoffs included 1,600 Xbox workers, with more to come this year, in a broader reorganization designed to reset Xbox as it faces heightened competition, the company said on Monday. Our business today is not healthy, said a memo from Xbox CEO Asha Sharma, who took over the gaming division earlier last year. We are operating at margins that are 3 to 10 times lower than comparable platforms and publishing businesses. Sharma said the industry in which Xbox competes with Sony PlayStation and Nintendo Switch is facing a severe hardware crisis as costs soar for console components. She said to expect another 1,600 job cuts over the course of the fiscal year that began last week. The company is also spinning off or selling 4 video game development studios previously acquired by Xbox. Compulsion Games and Double Fine Productions will now become independent again, and Ninja Theory and Undead Labs have entered terms for new ownership. The Xbox cuts, in addition to broader Microsoft layoffs that the software giant's chief people officer, Amy Coleman, tied to unspecified changes in customer needs, said, I also want to be direct that the roles eliminated today are not being replaced by AI. The layoffs followed voluntary buyouts that Microsoft began offering to about 8,750 people back in May, and more than 30% of eligible workers accepted those voluntary retirement offers, Coleman said last Monday.
And that's our show for this week. Once again, we're asking our labor partners, locals, and regional officers to seriously consider underwriting this show, because Working Voices and KPFK could really use your support. So please contact the station at 818-985-5735 or kpfk.org to explore the possibilities. We want to hear from you. You can email your comments or questions to workingvoices@aol.com. Once again, this is Joe Ayala.
And this is Marissa Remsky.
Our thanks to Gary Scott, Dan McCrory, Steve Zeltzer, and Hal Lohr. And of course, our guests. And always remember to educate, agitate, and organize. Have a great week, everybody.
I got work to do. I got work, baby. I got a game. I got a work to do. I got so much work. Yeah.
Ooh.
Listener support comes in many forms. And now, there's one more way to give back. You can donate land or real estate to KPFK and help keep public media strong for future generations. We handle the process from start to finish, and your donation may qualify for a significant tax deduction. Turn your property into something meaningful. Visit kpfk.org/real estate or call 844-277-4663 to learn more.
Support comes from the Festival of Tabla, returning for 2 days of Indian classical music and dance on Saturday, August 22nd, and Sunday, August 23rd, at the Soka University Performing Arts Center in Aliso Viejo. Global virtuosos will present immersive workshops exploring ancient rhythmic traditions, world dance, and more.